I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. He hasn't appeared on the program in about 6 years. He first appeared 9 years ago when he was a columnist at the now-defunct Alt-Weekly Terminal City, which he eventually edited. He went on to report for 24 hours and then left the media, but he didn't become any less observant of the political scene, even when moving up to Fort St. John. Ian King joins me again. You can follow him on Twitter, at Ian King is the handle, as well as on Facebook. He's in Vancouver today, and while in town, I thought it would be ideal to get his views on politics and more, as we talked about all those years ago. We'll catch up, too, on the media and how he sees it. I'm curious to know what it's like to live up north as well. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program in studio today. Ian King, Mr. King, good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
I just realized that you first came on the program 9 years ago,
yeah,
but we'd never met.
Yeah, which is interesting because at the time we only lived about 15 blocks apart. I was at 12th and Clark, roughly.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so you've had to move away to come back in person, I guess.
Yeah, go figure, eh? So, yeah. No, I didn't exactly travel 14 hours to be here, but no. It was on the way.
Yeah, but what... So you've been in town for the last little while, I understand.
Yeah, about 9 weeks.
Yeah, and that's having to do with what your job is today, is that right?
Yeah, well, you know, after washing out of journalism, going through the usual... a bit of angst, clinical depression, working a demeaning job for a company that shall remain nameless. I found myself dead-ended in Vancouver and wondering what to do. We decided to basically tear everything up, move up to the oil patch, because one can transition to a new career quite easily up there. Like, you know, you're not going to be spending a lot of time idling, studying in school, going deeper into debt. You just get out there and work and start contributing right away, and then upgrade later. That is how it is. And so now I'm on track, and I'm having a really interesting life outside the press. And now I can write and comment for fun instead of trying to make a living at it, which, given the state of the media and the market for writers these days, is probably a good thing.
Yeah. So you don't miss it at all, do you?
Oh, I miss it.
Yeah, you do?
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I mean, it was one of the best jobs I've ever had. And, you know, for a while there at Terminal City and at 24 hours, I was able to avoid having a quote-unquote real job while maintaining an upper-lower-class lifestyle.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing about the media. And, I mean, it is a tough business, isn't it? And it's a tough market. Mm.
And it's just gotten worse because the value for reporting has gone down and down. God forbid you want to be a commentator or anything like that, because now the value of commentary on the market is just about zero these days.
Yeah. But you have kept in touch, and we have kept in touch on Facebook, and so that, you know, I've read your views on politics and the sort.
Yeah.
So what do you make of what's happened in Vancouver? I'll always remember when you came on the show, I forget what it was, I think it was the morning after one of the elections that Robertson had been elected. And do you remember what you said to him?
Oh, yeah, don't fuck this up. Yeah. Well, he's fucked this up. And, well, I was a great, I admit that, in 2008, I was in the position where I was free to offer my opinions, and my view was that Vancouver needed a change, and that Gregor Robertson was the guy to do the job. I hoped that he would put the city squarely on a path towards the affordable housing they talked about and ending homelessness that he's talked about, but he really hasn't come through. And while there have been some gains at the very low end of the of society in terms of supportive housing for the hard to house and the preservation of some single occupancy rooms and conversion of old hotels, we have at the same time seen the loss of existing SROs, and worst of all has been the housing for the people who aren't really poorly off, but are just scraping by. We're talking about the delivery drivers, the warehousemen, the cashiers, the baristas, mm-hmm, of Vancouver, and they're squished. And Robertson has really, I think, failed them.
And so, when having the perspective of having lived here and then having gone away and then come back to visit, if you will,
yeah.
Is the city a worse place than, say, it was 6-7 years ago?
I think it's getting a little worse because, well, we have had the odd, you know, success job-wise. They haven't been all that. They haven't been all that great, and they haven't been. And they've been very specialized employment. Meanwhile, housing has just gotten more expensive. Well, the wages for a lot of the occupations that are frankly needed to keep a city running, again, the people who I was just talking about, their wages have been stagnant or barely holding on to inflation being outstripped by rent.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel, if you will. I mean, what happens here? I mean, does it just become too expensive for people?
Ultimately,
to live
here? I think the government does have to get involved in the housing market and start saying, well, ultimately, the buying and selling of property of the stock of property where people are living, is this place going to be just a place? A pied-à-terre for multimillionaires from away from Vancouver, because when you have them competing against the rank and file of the city for the same or similar hunks of housing, yeah. Well, the multimillionaires who can actually afford to have a second or third place are always going to beat the people who are just trying to get their primary. I think that we should have preferential treatment for people's primary residences, for people who live and work in the city.
Yeah.
That's, you know, the market is distorted.
And so living in Fort St. John, as you do, it seems like it's a much better lifestyle, is it?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, there are concerns that the place is getting overheated. It is crazy to think that a starter home in Fort St. John will set you back at least $250,000, probably in the $300,000 to $350,000 range. Hmm. At the same time, that is a single detached.
Yeah.
And the difference is that, well, you've got a lot of people who are in Vancouver who are struggling in the teens of dollars per hour. Yeah. In Fort St. John, most people won't lift a finger for less than 20, and they are raking in the overtime in a big way. You look at the average income up there, the average household income is about $90,000.
Hmm.
So if you've got people earning more than they do in Vancouver, but having to pay less for a house, well, okay, people can actually make a go of her. Even then, it's kind of distorted because the amount of money that you can work in some oil patch jobs is crazy. At the same time, you also have people spending money on things other than housing, which I guess helps to cool it down. But yeah, Fort St. John is on the verge of going crazy, but thankfully it's not Fort Mac. You're not looking at $1.5 million for a house there. If you're spending $1.5 million for a house in the Peace River Country in BC, you're probably buying an executive custom-designed 4,000 square foot home on a quarter section overlooking the confluence of two rivers.
Yeah. So when we talk in down south here about issues like the oil patch or pipelines and the sort, your perspective is obviously different than a lot of, say, what happens down here. Is it, I mean, is that an accurate observation on my part?
Well, yeah, in the sense that now I really do see the production side of it.
Yeah.
Although, even when I was at Terminal City, I mean, we were strongly in favor of the natural gas industry in BC. We saw that it was bringing in billions of dollars a year to the provincial treasury, which is billions of dollars that you don't have to raise through other means.
Hmm.
So, and I had the advantage that my boss at the time used to be the ministerial assistant to Paul Ramsey, who was the finance minister in the last NDP government. So I had a little bit of extra perspective on how money goes into the provincial capital.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, I was fairly pro oil and gas then. I guess I still am, obviously, but what people in the city should realize is that, in fact, there are some, you know, it isn't great, but it's nowhere near as bad as it's made out to be in some of the alternatives to media.
Mm-hmm.
But again, nobody's up there telling the stories of the people up there.
So did you find it, when you're looking at how these issues are covered, the perspective of people up north on the coast say that's not in that we don't have a sense of that down here.
We don't, for the most part. There are some good exceptions. Justine Hunter over at the Globe and Mail is regularly. She may not travel up to the piece, uh-huh, but at least she gets on the blower with whether it's Laurie Ackerman, the mayor of Fort St. John, or some of the movers and shakers around there to ask, okay, you know, what are you thinking? Well, at least, you know, at least she's making an effort. You know, at the other end of things would be, if you're reading, say, the Tai, it's just a hatchet job by their energy writers, who are mostly regurgitating claims from people who are either filing lawsuits against the oil and gas industry. And let's face it, you have to check something out when someone is making a wild claim, and when they're trying to argue it in court. You should really go and check out the other side of the story and make sure that what they're saying adds up. Well, there's not much of that. And you often get a real lot of distortions. For example, fears over fracking, hydraulic fracturing, for those who haven't yet heard about how you get gas out of shale. And it often gets conflated with older issues around oil and gas. For example, you'll have people getting very paranoid against hydrogen sulfide, which is something that I worry about on a daily basis out in the field, because that stuff can knock you down and kill you with a lung full of the stuff. But, ironically, well, that was a big problem with conventional natural gas, the stuff that's been heating our homes in BC for over a half century. A lot of the shales don't have very much of the stuff at all, which means that working around wells with that, one can, you know, be a little less paranoid about, you know, about whether a release of any product is going to knock someone dead.
So what I was just thinking about as I was listening to you was, as a media consumer, I mean, that's what I consider myself as.
Yeah.
What tools would I need to wade through all of this? I mean, we're going into a federal election in the next year or so, less than a year. It seems that if the media isn't doing the job that it's supposed to, or it can't do the job it's supposed to, what should the average citizen do, say?
Well, you've got to be really picky about where you get your your info. Now, you could, if you've got a lot of time, you could pick up on sources like that are very anti-energy, like most of the lefty media, like the Georgia Strait and the Tai. But then you'd also have to go and read all the counterweights from things like Pipeline News North or Alberta Oil Magazine. And even then, it is hard, because the people who write for the magazines, both the industry-friendly and the industry-hostile ones, don't often talk to the workers involved. It's always to managers and executives and consultants who, you know, well, they certainly do know things, you know, probably don't have much experience, you know, yanking pipe on a drilling rig or commissioning a pipeline.
So when we see protests, say, on Burnaby Mountain, is that an accurate depiction of where the public is on issues like this?
I think that, I mean, there are certainly some people who are just opposed to all fossil fuel development, period.
Yeah.
I think that the amount of hysteria that's been going on around that pipeline is pretty crazy. Yes, Kinder Morgan was drilling core samples, but that is what you have to do when you're building a big hunk of infrastructure, whether it's a bridge or whether it's a pipeline. The way that people were talking about oil tanker traffic in Vancouver, it was, you know, you and about the possibility for a catastrophic spill, you'd think that every third tanker that went out of Westridge ran aground and spilled, when in fact, that's nowhere near the case. But, again, people tend to believe a lot of what they want to believe, and they tend to believe the worst of what they're told. For example, people thinking that the possibility of liquefied natural gas in British Columbia will lead to giant fireballs on the coast, when, in fact, there really hasn't been anything of that sort in 40-plus years of shipping liquefied natural gas worldwide. So why would we be worse than the rest of the world at handling what is a dangerous but useful product? And let's face it, when you're shipping in large bulk, you end up taking much larger precautions. I'd much rather that petroleum products be transported by ship or by pipeline than by truck, because trucks crash all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that's going to make things safer up in my neck of the woods is that Pembina Pipelines are extending the network of where they collect natural gas condensate, which is a very light, volatile product. They are extending their collection system further up the Alaska Highway, which is going to mean fewer tankers hauling this condensate back from the areas north of Fort St. John, back to Fort St. John, or possibly even Fox Creek, Alberta. They'll be able to dump it north of Fort St. John and keep that stuff off the road and into a pipeline where it's a lot safer.
Yeah. So would you talk to me about the state of the media and how you see it? Because, I mean, you're someone who's worked in the media for a number of years. You still obviously are quite interested in it, and you follow it, you know, as we all do.
Yeah.
What needs to happen to the media? Can it be better?
That's obvious, but at the moment I'm feeling really quite pessimistic about the whole thing.
Yeah.
I think that we may need to hit a big trough before we rebuild. I mean, I think that the BuzzFeedication of our news may have to continue for a while. I mean, you saw that incredible irony 2 weeks ago when the editor-in-chief of Clickhole, the BuzzFeed parody, was hired away.
Mm-hmm.
By BuzzFeed. Well, I think that this is, you know, I mean, I was half expecting the internet to implode at that point.
Yeah.
But we're in a state where most of the existing, you know, I hate the term legacy media,
yeah,
are cutting reporters left, right, and center. I mean, the Vancouver Sun's a skeleton of what it used to, you know, it's a shadow of its former self. That, you know, you can count the number of really good reporters there on on one hand now.
Yeah. And so, did,
even, you know, radio's getting...
Yeah, radio and TV.
Radio's getting worked to nothing. And again, you know, as much as I would love to be a radio reporter, I can't afford to live on $11 an hour, man. neither can most of us. And the CBC continues to be starved. I mean, yeah, a rebuild of the CBC would be nice.
Yeah.
And for those of you who want to read someone who's actually thought more about this than I do, Google up Terry Glavin and his more recent columns in the Ottawa Citizen about the CBC, where he points out that in an era of propaganda, a reasonably independent voice is important, but we should also be suspicious of some of those people who want to refund the CBC, lest they wish to turn it into a propaganda organ themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Terry is much smarter than I am.
he's an excellent writer, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Well,
he and I are kind of kindred spirits. I mean, we both have a very hoserish background. He grew up in Edmonds. I grew up in New West, Irish Catholics. You get the drift.
Yeah.
Call it dropouts, too.
So why don't you write more?
Well, for about 3 or 4 years there, I was pretty brutally depressed, and now I'm heavily medicated. And now I mostly do it for fun, but I still still, if I'm writing for anyone other than myself, I don't write for free.
Mm.
Unfortunately, one of the major papers was ready to give me an op-ed at the end of the last election cycle in Vancouver. And I would have done it on, you know, I'd like to say that realistically I would have liked $150 for 600 or 700 words. That's not unreasonable, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Realistically, I would have taken $50. But I am not going to legitimize asking people to work for free in any way, shape, or form. I mean, this is this is a major daily newspaper. This is not Habitat for Bloody Well Humanity.
So see certain people in the media, say online or in print, they are probably doing it for free. What is that a reflection, say, on them, or is it a reflection on the state of the media today?
It's a reflection on the state of the media because of the fact that that editors have figured out that you can get people to write for free, especially if they're self-interested. If you read the Vancouver Sun or the Province's op-eds, how many times is it written by someone from a union, a foundation, a business advocacy group?
Think tank, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, in other words, the stuff's all canned. It's being sent out for free. I mean, I used to get this stuff at Terminal City.
Yeah.
Where, you know, like the Cato Institute. The Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank trying to pitch.
Terminal City?
Yeah. an alternative weekly that wasn't exactly left-wing, but sure wasn't crazy libertarian.
Yeah. So looking at, because I already mentioned that we're less than a year to a federal election.
Yeah.
What do you think the issues will be that we'll talk about? I mean, are they the same things that we're talking about today?
I think that for the most part, yeah, the economy will still end up being the big issue. It always is.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, has anything but the economy really been, you know, aside from maybe 2006 when tiredness with the liberals and their shenanigans was a theme, it's been the economy stupid since about 1988 in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly was in 2013 in British Columbia when the focus shifted from a very tired liberal government into an NDP government that a lot of people didn't trust. And I certainly got the sense, after the so-called Kinder Surprise, when then-NDP leader Adrian Dix announced unilaterally his opposition to a pipeline expansion project, you could just see those seats in the interior, where a lot of those construction jobs for that pipeline would be had, were shifted from orange to liberal blue, and even in the Peace River country, which is, you know, one of the most rock-solid conservative regions of British Columbia, everyone up there had priced in the idea that the NDP was going to win, that the high earners would pay a couple extra points of income tax, but things would go on as they did before. After that announcement, people actually got motivated to vote for the Liberals, which is pretty impressive for a fairly worn-out government.
Yeah. What do you make of the performance of the NDP since? I mean, they have a new leader now. I mean, will that resonate in your part of the world, say?
No.
Yeah.
No. The NDP continues to shoot itself in the foot for a lot. They've just proposed bringing back a long gun registry. Well, this isn't, you know, a huge issue. It is a bit of a cultural one.
Yeah.
And it'll be used by the Conservatives and by a lot of people themselves to say, I'm not going to vote NDP because they don't understand the way we live up here. They don't understand that, yeah, sometimes we do shoot horses when they've broken a leg.
Yeah.
And the idea that they went about this and just said, okay, this is what we're going to do, and you dumb hicks should follow us. That's not going to be well received, I think, in the rural West and in a lot of other small town areas. You know, the NDP's general hostility towards the energy sector obviously isn't going to help at all. I mean, they do have some good ideas. I mean, I think that their idea of a sliding scale average $15 a day childcare plan could be a real winner, because that's a bread-and-butter issue. It doesn't play identity politics, and it really does speak to a concern that a lot of Canadians have. And why they aren't hammering on this, and, well, they try to figure out what they want to do with the economy is a mystery to me. You know, send some consistent signals saying, all right, we're on your side, we get that you're squeezed, so we're going to help relieve your squeeze. And spend a few months just not talking about economic matters while you figure out how to convince people who like that message that, oh yeah, we're not going to make any hasty decisions that's going to mean that you're going to be getting a layoff notice.
The Green Party and how they figure in our politics, say, at all three levels. I mean, since we've talked, you have a Green MLA, a Green MP. In the last week here in Vancouver.
Isn't that so wonderfully over the map, though? Between the Greens. I mean, the lone Green MLA in Victoria, Andrew Weaver, I think is a really good contributor. Like, genuinely, you know, he, like, you know, I'm impressed with how he engages people online. Like, people mm-hmm. are just asking questions of him.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of his criticisms of the Liberal government are cogent, and I'm not saying that because he's a useful tool for the BC Liberals, because I'm not a fan of them at all. I just think he's a really good performer. That doesn't say anything about his party. Federally, we have the Green Party. People had some fun with Elizabeth May presenting that 9/11 truther petition to Parliament. But, you know, I suppose that she is representing her riding, which is the flakiest in Canada by a long shot.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, May in a lot of ways, I mean, sure, she does some parliamentary stuff, but a lot of her beliefs are just out to lunch. The idea that Wi-Fi is going to corrupt your precious bodily fluids, which goes against all the best scientific evidence I've seen mustering, both theoretical and, you know, and practical evidence. Or the Green Party's ongoing support of quackery and homeopathy. And provincially, they've cleaned up quite a lot. I mean, in 2005, I wrote a blistering column about them, saying that, you know, there is no way that anyone should vote for a party that wants the public to pay for your chakra realignment.
But they've
cleaned up. The feds are still crazy. The Green Party in Vancouver is a real force, though.
Yeah,
we saw that.
With Janet Fraser and the school board.
Oh, my, yeah.
What did you make of the reaction on social media to what she did in terms of because it's split between the Vision and the NPA, and
she's the swing vote.
So she voted with the NPA in terms of determining who the chair would be.
Yeah.
Social media reacted, and what did you make of
that? It was violent, and I thought that Vision were horribly sore losers about this. It is true that Patty Backus did get more votes than anyone else for school trustee. A lot of her colleagues were tossed from the board, and there's nothing anywhere that says that the top vote getter is to be the school board chair.
Hmm.
I mean, if you're gonna say that that's the way it should be, say that before the election.
Yeah.
And I think that it's really hard to interpret the election results, I find, at school board, because, well, it's pretty clear that Vision got a bit of a slapdown. The Vision Vancouver school trustees, who were the most vocal backers of the teachers and the BC Teachers Federation in the recent school strike, also placed quite highly in the polls, that being Patty Backus and Mike Lombardi. Yeah. Lombardi, of course, being a former BCTF staffer, so that shouldn't surprise anyone. Yeah. So, ultimately, I think that, you know, Fraser did what she did. I think that she, you know, I mean, I accept the rationale that she didn't want a really a really aggressive and oppositional school board chair. And I think it was quite clever to bring in Christopher Richardson, who is, you know, one of the coolest heads in the Vancouver political game, to be the board chair. But just the viciousness with which Vision Vancouver supporters reacted to this was, I think it was unseemly. And I think that Vision Vancouver's conduct since the election has been pretty poor. Consider that at City Hall, despite losing a couple of council seats, Gregor Robertson announced that the deputy mayor position, which used to be a rotating thing that just went from one councillor to the next month by month,
mm-hmm.
was now going to be handed over to his closest political ally, along with the $40,000 a year or so bonus that comes with that. With no discussion,
mm-hmm.
with no debate, with no saying, hey, this might be a good idea, you've just turned something that was a rotating perk of office that didn't really favor anyone except for, well, the top vote getters got to do it a little more often. Mm-hmm. You turned that into a political football with which to reward people and keep people in line.
You know, if that's the case, then Adrienne Carr would be deputy mayor, because she was a top vote getter, right?
Yeah, and
but Vision never says that.
No. You see, that the top vote getter is very important for being school board chair, apparently,
yeah.
I'm told.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely irrelevant towards the position of deputy mayor.
Ian, it's been such a pleasure to meet you finally.
Yes.
And it's great to have you on the program again after 6 years. And next time you're in Vancouver, do drop by, would you?
Oh, yeah. I'll be back next August or so.
Ian King, at Ian King, is the Twitter handle. You can also find him on Facebook. Ian King joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.